Motherhood, time of motherhood. So please join me in welcoming Julie Roller.
I feel like Michelle should get a gold star because everyone always says Roller. You're like the first one ever. Say my name right. Okay, we'll just leave that there for a minute. So I'm Julia, and actually most people now call me either Ben's mom or Luke's mom. Can any of you relate to that phenomenon? See the pediatrician, the people at school, the Sunday school teachers, even my in-laws. Ben's mom, Luke's mom. And I kind of love it, I'll admit. I kind of love being called Ben's mom or Luke's mom because being a mom is such a gigantic part of my identity now. I almost feel like a little lost when I'm at a place like this and they're not with me. Like, really, I am a mom, I have kids, that's such a big part of me. But that identity of becoming, of going from Julia, you know, wife, writer, editor, all the things I was before, to becoming mom, it wasn't that easy for me. It was a big change. So let me take you back to that moment. My husband and I moved here to San Diego about 9 years ago, and I got pregnant like 5 minutes later, which was wonderful. It was great, except we didn't know anybody here. I had one friend, and she didn't have any kids, and it occurred to me in a small way when I was pregnant that that could be a problem. Like, I didn't know any other moms or any other kids, really. So I thought, gosh, I need to really prepare for being a mom. I need to prep. So I took a bunch of classes. Did any of you take classes when you were pregnant? Like, yeah. So I took CPR, I took first aid, I took caring for a newborn, I took some weird class at Babies R Us that was not that helpful. Frankly. I even took a class on breastfeeding. And let me tell you, that's kind of an interesting scenario. A bunch of women who have not yet had a baby, and men, and the dads too, and believe me, those were some scared-looking men in that room. So we're all watching a video that this woman had helpfully set up for us. And the video is of a woman breastfeeding successfully, and the instructor says, you've got to watch for the ear. The baby's ear twitch, you've got to watch, and the ear wiggles or twitches, and that's how you know everything's going well. So we're all like squinting, and like, I mean, and I'm like, I saw it, but I didn't see it. I didn't see it. I don't know what she was talking about. I'm still not all that sure what she was talking about. But anyway, here I was. I took all my classes. I was so ready, and I had my son, Ben, and I was the most proud mom ever. You know, I was just like shooting out little sparks of like excitement. I'm like, look at this baby, he's mine. And everything went great, with the usual like lack of sleep and weird body things that happened. But until about 4 weeks, until he was 4 weeks old, and my wonderful mother, who had been there for his birth and then gone back to Illinois, she came back to see us, and she took one look at him, and she said very gently, gosh, I don't think he's any bigger than when I left. And I was like, what? Because, Mom, that's not possible, because all I have been doing with my sweet baby is sitting on the couch and feeding him. That's all we do all day. This is the groove that I have worn into the couch where we sit all day and all night, and we nurse. And believe me, there's no way he's not bigger, because all he does is eat. And she's like, okay, honey, well, this, maybe we'll just go get him weighed at the doctor's just to be sure. And I was like, okay, Mom, fine, humor Nana. So we take him in, and she was right. He was actually at that point 4 weeks old, 12 ounces lighter than when he had been born. So that was obviously really scary, and things were not fine. He was not fine, and, you know, he ended up fine. I'll just tell you that now. Everything ended up being okay, but at the time it was this really long and scary journey of like, what happened? Like, why is he not gaining weight? Am I doing something wrong? Is he doing something wrong? Probably many of you have been through this, you know. So we started the pumping and the formula and the more pumping and the giving him the breast milk that I managed to pump, which wasn't much, and then the formula and then washing it all and starting all over again. And it was a hard time, and I felt like I was shrinking as a person, and I felt like, here I was. I took the class on breastfeeding. What went wrong? Like, I thought I was prepared. I thought I was going to do this so well, and I have failed. And what was hardest, I think, about feeling that I failed that way was I didn't even notice. I didn't even notice he wasn't getting any bigger. My mom had to tell me. Thank goodness for my mom, really. But anyway, it was a hard time, and I cried a lot. And I counted down each day by the TV programs that we watched together. And I would say to myself, okay, if we could just make it to the X-Files, then we'll feed one more time, and then I will walk the dog, and then Daddy will come home. And I was so excited for Daddy to come home. And then often my husband would call and say, I'm so sorry, honey, but it's really busy at work right now, and I'm going to have to work late again. And I'd feel like, ah, like a part of me just broke off. I didn't realize at the time that so many men react to being a parent with the need to provide. You know, that was important to him. But at the time, all I could think about was, I am alone with this baby, and we are crying together. I would hold him, and he'd be weeping because he was hungry, and we would cry together, and I would think, God, how can I last 18 more years of this? Because that's how I felt at the time. It's going to be 18 more years exactly like this every second. Let's talk about tunnel vision, right? So I struggled. And I learned later it wasn't that unusual what I went through. And actually, studies show that parents are less happy than non-parents. Does that surprise you? Maybe not. That's all right. I get it. We're all moms here. We can be honest. But truthfully, that's contrary to what most of us think before we become a parent, right? Most of us think before becoming a parent, like, this will bring so much, and it does. I mean, of course, babies bring so much happiness to our lives, but it's a big change. And studies also show that we're most unhappy during the first few years of our children's lives. Those early years are the hardest. Studies also show that even though we parents in the United States work longer hours than ever before, we also spend more hours with our children. So parents in the U.S. spend more time with their kids than parents in any other developed country. So what I see when I read statistics like that is that we are just pushing ourselves so hard from every angle. Like, we're going to be the perfect parents, but we're also going to succeed in our jobs, and we're going to do everything right, and we are dying under the weight of our own expectations. And I think that was what was happening to me. I had such high expectations, and when I completely failed to meet them, I fell apart. And I suffered from anxiety and self-doubt. And one of the hardest things for me was that I felt I was slipping away from God. I felt like before I became a mom, I had all the quiet and alone time I wanted, pretty much. I mean, I worked at home. So if I wanted to just make the bed and pray while I was doing it, I mean, I could do that very peacefully. And that changes when you have a child. Suddenly, you can no longer have quiet and alone time whenever you want it. And I was really struggling, and I was struggling with how, you know, God, you gave me this baby, and I'm not doing a good job. I failed you, God. And it felt even worse, these struggles I was going through, because here I was, this strong Christian, I thought, who had been writing about God for years. I'd been writing, editing books about God. That was my job. And it was kind of embarrassing, really. I mean, here I am. I'm struggling so much, and it was embarrassing to even admit to myself. You know, one of the reasons, according to this book about parenting called, I love this title, All Joy and No Fun. Isn't that a great title? All Joy but No Fun. I think we have fun too, but you get the point. One of the reasons, according to that book, that parenting is so hard is because we're not sure what we're raising our children to be. People in America, we're not necessarily sure what we're raising our children to be. It used to be that you raised your children to do whatever you did. So if you were a locksmith, you taught your son, maybe your daughter, how to be a locksmith, or a farmer, or a baker, or whatever it was that you did. But it hasn't actually been that long that we have not been doing it. We've been raising our children to do whatever they want to do. Sometimes I think in America we raise our kids with no more of a goal than just to grow up to be happy. And how do you really teach someone to grow up to be happy? I mean, that's a very vague goal. Like, it's very hard to direct someone toward that. And I think as Christians, we're really lucky because we have a different goal and we have a more focused goal. We want to raise our children to be faithful servants of God. We want to raise them to be more like Jesus. And so how do we do that? Any parenting expert will tell you, and I'm not claiming to be one, but any parenting expert will tell you that getting your children to do something depends a lot more on what you do, how you model it for them. So to raise our children to follow Jesus, they have to see us doing it. I think it's kind of funny, though, when you think about that, because it's not really the way we operate. I feel like, especially moms, like, we sacrifice our bodies and our nutrition and our rest just to be there for our kids, to make things better for them. And I myself, I always think of how I travel everywhere in the world with a gigantic amount of snacks and drinks for my children, who if they go 5 minutes without a drink of water could absolutely fall apart. I mean, just cannot handle it. And I carry nothing for myself. Like, I have no snack for myself. I have no water. And then and 4 hours later, as we're on our fun, like, event together, I'm like, why am I in such a bad mood? Like, they've been eating and eating and eating, and, you know, I'm giving them juice, giving them water, and I've had nothing to eat or drink, and I'm like, gosh, why am I so cranky? Why am I so rushed with them? Sometimes we put ourselves to the side because we want to make things better for our kids. But that's not necessarily the most effective way to make things better for them. And it's certainly not the most effective way to teach them. So I decided not only for my own spiritual development, but for the sake of my children's, I needed to make a better effort to be more in touch with God. Oh, baby. So what I did was I spent 1 year immersing myself in several different spiritual practices. I did one a month, and my book, Mom Seeks God, is about that year and how I practiced these. I'll tell you the disciplines I practiced. Prayer, fellowship, submission, study, simplicity, silence, fasting, worship, service, and celebration. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, I had varying levels of success. Some of them went really well, and some of them were a real struggle. And first, I think I'd like to, are you familiar with that term, like spiritual disciplines? Is that something? I mean, it sounds like kind of a scary term, like spiritual discipline, like something like means go in the desert and, you know, don't eat. But it really is just practices that Jesus showed us with his words and that we learn in the Bible about how to be closer to God. Things that he told us to do and things that we see that he did about that helped him to be closer to God, more in tune with God. So I'm going to talk to you today about some of the important things I discovered about the disciplines that I tried. And then at the end, we'll have time to talk in small groups about, hopefully we can learn from each other about how these are working in our own lives and where we want to be better. So the first discipline that I tried was prayer. And I knew that was going to be my first one because I had missed prayer so much. You know, I was working on a book at the time called A Year with God, and it's a wonderful book. You should all buy it. And in it, I kept writing this line, in your daily prayer time, when you pray today, in your daily prayer time. And I felt like this gigantic hypocrite because did I have a daily prayer time? No. I mean, I don't know if I even had a weekly prayer time at that point. Like, I felt like my prayer was just completely scattered and far apart and not organized at all. And so I thought, okay, I mean, I really need to fix this. The times that I had been used to praying before becoming a mom, I usually prayed at night. Do any of you, are you nighttime prayers, anyone? Pray before you go to bed? Yeah. So that's what I like to do. I mean, I'm a night owl. I'm like that weird mom who's like at 1 a.m. like wiping down the kitchen counters because that's my time, you know. I'm awake. I'm happy. And so I would pray then. But the trouble was, after becoming a mom, I was so completely tired, so exhausted, that I would get in my bed and I would lie down and I'd be like, thank you, Lord. And then I would fall asleep every single night. So it wasn't, actually, like, I was talking to a radio host about this, and he was like, well, you fell asleep connected. You didn't break the connection. You fell asleep connected. And I was like, that is a nice way to think about it, but I was hoping for a little more. And I also kind of had this idea of kind of, you know, connecting with God through the day called practicing the presence. Any of you have ever heard of that type of prayer, like where you just kind of keep a constant conversation with God behind the scenes as you're doing other things. But I was finding that I really wasn't very successful at doing that either. So I have a theory, actually, that a lot of us talk about prayer more than we actually do it, you know, and we mean well. We say, that is terrible, and I'll pray for you, and I'll pray for that person, and I want to pray for that situation. But sometimes we think, well, I really am going to pray, and I'm going to wait until I have some time to myself, and it's quiet, maybe I'll light a candle, and it'll be a special moment with God and me, and those moments are wonderful, but for me, they're very few and far between. And I imagine for many of you, they are few and far between too, those perfect moments of quiet and solitude. And so I think sometimes we all could use a little help figuring out, you know, how do we fit it in the way that our days actually work? I like this guy, Brother Lawrence, who talks about practicing the presence and, you know, praying throughout his day. And he talks about how he would pray among the pots and the pans. Because one of his jobs, he was a monk, and one of his jobs was working in the kitchen, and he would pray amongst the pots and the pans, and he would listen to God and talk to God. And And I was like, wow, that's great. I mean, I'm among the pots and the pans a lot, but I was finding that amongst the pots and the pans, I wasn't really praying. I was actually often thinking, I am really bad at this, or I wish my husband would come home from work more, or, oh my gosh, please don't wake up, because please sleep for 5 more minutes. Those are the things I was thinking. It was not prayer. So let me tell you some of the things that worked for me. I found that I figured out a type of prayer that helped me to pray at night, which was my first instinct. And what I needed, I think, was just a little more structure. I needed a plan. I needed a prayer plan. So I had this kind. I just tried this kind of prayer called the Examine. And has anyone ever prayed the Examine before? Ever heard of it? Yeah. Okay. So I did a very simplified version of it. And it was, so you would ask God. First you would think, where did I see God today? And for me, that was often very easy. It was when I was with my kids. I always think, oh, it's when, you know, we had this moment where, you know, he just smiled and I felt close to God in that moment. Or someone was kind to me at the store. Or my, you know, those were easy to come by, usually for me. The second part you think of is, where did I feel far from God today? And frankly, for me, that was usually also with one or both of my children. Oh, when I lost my temper, when I had to lock myself in the bathroom again, when I didn't behave the way that I really wanted to. And then the third part, you flow right into the third part, which is, I'm sorry that I did that, Lord, and how can I do better tomorrow? And I found that, so just those three steps, where did I see God? Where did I feel far from God? How can I do better tomorrow? And I felt like that was kind of a nightly strategy session with God. Like, we're working together to make me a better mom, to help me be more connected to you, Lord. And sometimes I could do the whole thing in like 30 seconds, and sometimes it would be longer. I would just kind of sit, and I enjoyed it. I'm like, we're working together here. And I felt positive about my prayer experience because I was, you know, feeling like I'm really, this is helping me. It was very practical for me. And I found that when I got a nighttime prayer practice in like that, it was easier for me to see God during the day. Seeing God in the pots and pans became easier. Seeing God in the moment with my kids, in the moment with other people, that became easier. And it's also, I noticed too, that there were certain repetitive tasks in my life that were very conducive to praying. I don't know if any of you have found that, like maybe in the shower, or maybe walking, or maybe cooking. Probably for those of you who are better cooks than me, I'm a terrible cook, so I really need to pay a lot of attention when I'm cooking so I don't cut myself or burn myself or something else goes really wrong. But when I do a task like that, you know, your arms or your body is working, but your mind is free because you're doing something that's so familiar, and that's really a great time I've found to kind of meet God, to talk to God, let God show you things, to listen for God, and to, you know, so I find like there are moments like that I plan. Okay, when I'm in the shower today, I talk to God about this. Thank God for that. You know, ask God for that. These kind of things. When I'm going to go on a walk with my dog, maybe I'll have a chance to do that. So those were some of the ways that I was able to bring prayer back into my life. And the next practice I'm going to talk about is fellowship. And I actually love talking about this with MOPS groups because you guys are all already doing it. But it's hard for moms. Fellowship can be very, very hard for moms. There was a study in 2009 that showed that 80% of mothers felt like they didn't have enough friends. 80%, that's a lot. And 58% reported that they felt lonely. And again, the most lonely were those with children under 5. So that's probably all of us here in a MOPS group. You know, we're alone with our kids a lot, and that is wonderful, but you get to the point, I think, if you're like me, where you realize that you really do need to be around adults and talk about things other than, you know, Elmo or whatever, kids talk. My kids just talk about soccer now, so I don't know. They're a little bit older. But I realize that I really need to be around other moms. This was hard for me because I'm introverted. Now, I'm not going to ask who's introverted because if you, those of you don't raise your hand. Who's extroverted? There we go. Okay, so the rest of you. maybe you're introverted like me, which basically just means that you kind of recharge by being by yourself. So that where you find energy is not from like going to a party, even though you may really enjoy that. Where you find energy is kind of being alone, or maybe just being with your husband, just being with one person, or just being by yourself. So that's how I have always been. And I felt that being home when my kids were small, it was like my fortress. It was such a relief. Do you ever feel that way? Like you'd be out and you just feel like every fiber of your being is like is focused on keeping them like in line, like making sure everything's going okay, making sure they don't injure themselves or yell, or making sure they're fed and watered and all the things. And then you just get home and you just shut the door and you're just like, oh my gosh. Like it's such a relief. you know, just to be like, okay, now you can just kind of run wild, and, you know, there's no one watching me anymore to see if you're doing anything wrong. So that's how I often felt, and I think that was preventing me from, it was isolating me. I think it was preventing me from really going out and having fellowship, especially with other moms. So what I did that month was I told myself, and it was hard for me, I had to say yes to every single fellowship opportunity that came my way. So every single MOPS event, every mom's night out, I was doing stroller strides at the time, every little thing with that, every church event, I had to say yes to and go. And that was really, really hard for me. Sometimes my husband would literally have to shove me out the door, be like, you will have fun when you go. I know you're not, you know, I know maybe you don't think you will, but you will have fun if you go. And I did. I actually really did. And the other thing I realized was that what was holding me back, too, was a sense of maybe a sense of competitiveness. I was so worried because, as I mentioned, I really wanted to be a good mom, and I felt like I'd failed very early at that. I was really worried that people would see, I would tell them about things that were going on with my family, or they would see me, and they would think, wow, she's not a very good mom. And that was such a concern to me. I wanted people to think I was a good mom, and I think I was holding back from other people because I wanted to maintain that pretense, that facade. And that's one of the reasons why MOPS was so amazing for me, and I imagine it's the same for a lot of you. For me, it was a place where you could really be honest, you could be vulnerable, and you could say to someone, because this is what I found, 99 times out of 100 when I would say to someone, I'm really scared that my son is a bully. Like, he hit someone in preschool, and I don't know what to do about it. They would say, oh, that's nothing. Are you kidding me? At my house, oh, you should see my kids. They're like gladiators all the time. And the other day, my son just totally kicked someone in the playground, and he almost had to go to the hospital. And then you're just like, oh, wow, really? I mean, I just found that when I was able to be honest and be vulnerable and just open up, then always someone had another story. Always someone else could relate. 99 times out of 100. There was a very occasional time when someone would be like, really? A bully? That's terrible. So sorry. I will not be going to a play date at your home. But that was really the exception. Most of the time, people were so kind, and then they felt like they could open up to me about things they were struggling with, and we could help each other. And that's what's required to have fellowship with someone. You have to first put yourself in the position to say yes, and second, you have to open up and be vulnerable and be honest about what's going on with you, because if you don't present yourself as you really are, you can't have fellowship with anybody. So that was hard for me to learn, but I realized that if I could seek it out and if I could be vulnerable, then I could really benefit from that fellowship that I had. And as I mentioned, I found a lot of that in our MOPS group. So I always just love speaking to groups like you because I know you're already doing that. So the next practice that I want to talk about is simplicity. And I have to tell you, I was so excited that month I was going to practice simplicity. I'm like, this is amazing. I'm going to practice simplicity. And so I'm going to get my house organized, and it's going to look so good, and I'm going to get everything put away, and I'm going to have, like, artfully placed throw pillows on the couch. And then I started thinking, gosh, I think maybe my idea of simplicity is more based on, like, Real Simple magazine than, like, an HGTV than maybe the Bible, which is what I was trying, you know, meet God. How do I meet God in that? So it turns out, this may shock you, there are no throw pillows in the Bible. Did you know that? I mean, if you know of any passages, let me know. I would be interested, but I haven't found any. So when I went to the Bible and I started looking to try to find out what does simplicity mean in a biblical sense, I first turned to Matthew 6, 25 through 34, which is one of my favorite mom passages. I just love that passage. And it's that passage where Jesus says, do not worry, do not be anxious about your life. You can see how well I'm terrible at memorizing the Bible, but I will badly paraphrase it for you. But he says, you know, look how beautifully God takes care of the birds. Look how beautifully the flowers are clothed. If any of you could, you know, if God takes care of them, how much more is he going to take care of you? And in the end, he says, just seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all shall be added. Do not worry about tomorrow, what will happen tomorrow. So I think that's just good, such good advice for moms and for me. And what I took from it about simplicity is that if we have a wholehearted focus on God, and we focus our attention on that, then the other things kind of fall into place. Simplicity is about how we are inside. It's not about how things look. So what was the keeping my life from being simple in this biblical way? And for me, it was what is talked about in the beginning of that passage. It was worry. It was anxiety. I was worried about everything all the time. I was worried about my kids. I was worried about how my house looked. I was worried about how I looked. I was worried about how the work I was not getting done. And it was There was a lot. I was filled with worry and anxiety, and it was keeping me from practicing simplicity. It was keeping me from focusing on God. And some of that was actual stuff in my house. That was part of it. So there is something to the real simple. There is. What I realized was that there were things in my house that were causing me a lot of stress and anxiety. And for me, mostly, it was piles of paper. So I don't know if any of you have a place in your home that just, like, gathers paper like a magnet. And it just, and no matter how often you deal with it, it just gets taller and taller. And this becomes so much worse when your kids go to school, I have to say. It's just a disaster. The amount of paper they bring home from school, I feel defeated. I feel defeated almost on a daily basis. I'm like, oh, you brought me more lovely artwork. Thank you. Not to put it on my pile. And so I had to, figure out how am I going to deal with these piles of paper that are causing me a lot of worry and anxiety, literally every time I walk by them in my house. So I put in place some strategies, and I'm not your organizer speaker. You may have a wonderful speaker come later who's really going to get you organized, and I hope you do because they're great. I'm not that person. I'm totally disorganized, so I needed some very basic strategies. So what I did was I stopped bringing paper home. My friend has a rule about leftovers at a restaurant. She's like, I don't let them follow me home, which I don't follow that rule. But I followed it with paper. I love to bring leftovers home. But with paper, I don't let paper follow me home. So when I'm at a meeting like this, and I have a discussion question or something, and I take notes with it in my phone, or I take a picture of it, and then I have it in my phone, and I don't take the paper with me. Because frankly, what happens with the paper is that I wrote down very important things, but then I go home and I put it in one of my piles, and I never see it again. Or when I do see it, I'm like, why did I even keep that? I don't even remember what I wrote there. Like, it was completely useless. So I don't let it follow me home. And I try to keep everything on my phone, and I use my picture thing a lot, and that really helps me. And I just try to keep the paper from accumulating in the first place, which is nothing shocking, but for me, it's required a lot of work. And a question that I like to ask myself, too, and this really becomes true of the artwork that my wonderful children bring to me, does this paper bring you joy? So that's kind of a good clarifying question for me. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, and I can admire it, and then I can hide it in the recycle bin under the newspapers so they don't see that I threw it away. Some of the other things that were causing me stress, not just my piles of papers, but my to-do list, and I keep that on my phone too, but I'll tell you, that to-do list is really long, and it always gets longer, and every time I just even glance at it or think about it, I feel completely stressed out. And I realized that a lot of those things on my to-do list were more about what people thought of me than maybe what actually needed to be done. So a strategy that I implemented was what I call the priority shuffle, where I try to look at my to-do list every day and think about it like God's looking at it with me. We're looking at it together. What would God do with my to-do list? How would God prioritize and reorder it? And I tell you, that's a pretty interesting exercise. And for me, it reordered things completely almost all of the time. So a lot of the things completely fall off the list. I'm like, well, that's really more about what people think of me, and it's not necessarily a really important thing to do. And other things show up on the list that I don't actually write down. These are things like call my mom, check in with her, because she would like me to call her every minute because she loves me so much, and I don't call her enough. So that's something that comes up on my list that I don't normally write down. Checking in with friends who maybe I knew were going through something. That's something I don't put on my to-do list, but when I think about it through God's eyes, I think that should be on my list, that kind of thing. So I think of it as my priority shuffle. But I have to tell you, the biggest obstacle to me in my life to simplicity was actually something that I always thought was a big strength of mine, and that was multitasking. We all multitask, right? Everybody in this room, I know you all multitask, because that's just basically the way we have to make our lives work as moms. 67% of moms say they multitask most of the time, compared with 42% of dads. And another study showed that moms spent 10 more hours a week multitasking than dads did. So this is because a lot of times we're wearing a lot more hats in our household. You know, we're doing the childcare and the housework and the scheduling, and probably to a larger extent than maybe the dads are. And researchers have also discovered that most moms do five things at a time most of the time. Now, when I read that, I thought, that seems pretty high. Five things, like, that's a lot. And then I started thinking, like, one day I was sitting in the doctor's office thinking about that, and I was watching my son kind of badly. But he was, you know, kind of coloring at a table, waiting for the doctor to call us. I was on my phone. I was kind of texting with my husband. I was kind of checking out an email. I had a magazine sitting there. I was kind of looking at that, and I'm like, how many things am I doing at once right now? I'm not doing any of them very well. I'm not really enjoying any of them either, because I'm doing so many things, I feel totally stressed. And I was becoming a lot of what I think of as in-a-minute mom, where I would say to my kids all the time, in a minute, I know you want me to come and do that, but just in a minute, because I need to empty the dishwasher and then throw this load in the washer. And then, wait, I really need to sign you up for soccer class. And also, I just really need to chop something up so dinner is going to be ready later. And then I was starting to read this email, and maybe I should respond to that right now. And it's never just in a minute for me. It was always like many, many minutes. And then my poor children sometimes would come back to me, and that's pretty devastating. Say, Mom, you said you'd be here in just a minute. And I'm like, oh, I did say that. I did say that. So, like me, I think many of you probably live in what researchers call contaminated time, which is where we're always thinking about what we're going to do next. Even so, when I first heard that phrase, I thought of myself in church during the sermon typing up my grocery list surreptitiously, which I've done. But we're always thinking about what are we going to do next? What have we done? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And it's not the way I want to live. It's not the way I want to live, to have all my time be contaminated. So some of the strategies that I have implemented to help with that are what I call conscious segmenting of my time, where for me, I work at home. And so the three areas that completely bleed into each other are housework, like cooking, cleaning stuff, time with my kids, and then my work. So those things are always like bleeding into each other, and it's very hard for me to separate them. So I try very hard to do that. I'm lucky enough, both of my kids are in school some days, you know, for a few hours a week. And so when that happens, that time for me is for work. Even if the kitchen is a complete disaster, and often it is, that time is for work. That is only for work. That is for emails and writing and things like that. And then there's time that I do home stuff that is set aside for cooking, cleaning, things like that. And then there's time that's set aside just for the kids. And just mentally knowing that I have time set aside to answer the emails tomorrow morning helps me to give myself permission, you know, to spend time with the kids now and put my phone away and lose my phone, which is a big part of segmenting your time for me. Knowing that I'm going to do the dishwasher and the laundry at that time helps me to not worry about it now. So it's really, I'm not the biggest planner, but it's really been helpful for me to just try to plan out those various segments of time so that I can, you know, appreciate what I'm doing in the moment so that I can, when I'm actually working, and I tell you what, I'm so much more efficient and effective at all of it. And I enjoy being with my kids so much more when I know that this is my time to be with them and I have it actually scheduled, which may sound unpleasant, but it's really nice to work into your schedule. So that's what I recommend for simplicity, if you can try to work that out. And I think I'm just going to talk about one more practice today, and that is silence. So silence is another practice. I really, really long to have more silence in my life after becoming a mom. I just felt like everything is so noisy, especially after having two kids. I'm like, oh, it's just so noisy. Their toys are noisy. They're noisy. Everything's noisy. It's noisy, noisy all the time. And I felt like having silence would be impossible. Like, it would be very nice to go for a three-day silent retreat, but that's never, ever going to happen for me. So oh well, I'll never have silence. But I really felt called to try to do a month where I was going to have more silence in my life. And what I realized when I kind of focused on my life and things that were happening was that I was making a lot of the noise in my life. I was the one who was turning on the radio in the kitchen whenever I cooked. I was the one often listening to music while I was eating with my lunch with my kids or even breakfast. I was the one who's always turning on the radio or, you know, some kind of playlist in the car. I was just creating a lot of noise. And some of it wasn't even audible. Some of it was a book or a magazine or my phone. It was noise that was coming into my life that was taking my attention. And it was, and I realized all that noise was stressful. And it was making me anxious because there was a lot of it, and it was all the time. So I challenged myself to turn it off, to close the book, close the magazine, turn off the social media as much as possible, and to just, you know, be in silence as much as possible. And the most helpful practice I tried was something that was very simple. It was just writing alone in the car with the radio off, with no sound in the car. Especially in those minutes, I could do it without my kids being in the car. And what I found was I'd always thought music was this huge mood elevator, like, oh, I'm playing a song I like, and that's making me feel happy. But instead, I found that when I had silence in the car, that I felt a lot more calm, and I felt a lot more peaceful, and I felt like I arrived where I was going feeling a lot more just settled. And I also found that opened up some space in my life for God to talk to me more. I would find people coming up that I was thinking about, that I hadn't thought about in a while, maybe people that were struggling with something, and I would kind of have the chance to pray for them a little bit. And what also was very interesting was that my children started to ask for it. I would often get in the car, they're old enough that I can ask them, and I would say, do you want to have the radio on or do you want to just be in silence right now? And they would often say, let's just have it be quiet. I mean, I think our kids don't get quiet very much, and they like it too, and it's good for us to model it for them. So anyway, just I think it's something good for all of us to think about, just how much silence is there in our lives and how can we bring more in and how can we kind of model just being alone with our thoughts for our kids, because it's something that a lot of us really have very little of in today's world. So in conclusion, after trying all these disciplines for a year, and I only made it to 10, which is part of the story of the book. I only did 10 disciplines. I was going to do 12. I learned to be a little more gracious with myself. I feel like that's what God really taught me throughout the whole year, was that all this anxiety and self-doubt and this fear about not being perfect, that I really just needed to just give myself a little more grace. That, you know, parenting isn't something, you don't get an A at parenting. Parenting doesn't work that way. You just do your best, and then you trust that God is going to help you to be better. And I also started to appreciate the fact that as parents, we really get to practice a lot. So all that repetition in our lives as moms, that feels so exhausting. All the diapers that you change, all the lunches that you make, all the breakfast they make, all the endless cleaning up. I love that video that I showed. The stuff that you keep doing, and you feel like it gets undone immediately. All that stuff, I like to think of it as chances that I have to be better, chances that I have to be the parent that I want to be, to do it better next time, to do it with more joy and more sense of God's blessing. And I also learned that my tendency in trying to meet God was to do more. Like, I'm going to meet God, so I'm going to schedule more stuff. I'm going to go out and meet other people, and I'm going to work some study, and I'm going to plan some time for prayer, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to add this to my schedule that already felt very busy and overwhelming. And I learned so much more through those practices that were about taking things away. So when I practiced simplicity, when I tried to practice silence, when I worked on practicing fasting, I felt like what I was talking about with the silence, like I created space in my day to meet God. And I learned so much more through taking things away than from adding. And that was something that I've tried to carry forward to this day. And something else I learned that was surprised me, and many of you may have figured this out already, and I hope that you have, but in the end, I found it kind of ironic that I was looking so hard to meet God despite being a mother. Because motherhood itself is a spiritual practice. I mean, I firmly believe that. After spending a year with all these other practices, I felt like motherhood itself was the most powerful spiritual discipline. I learned the most about Jesus just trying to, in just my life as a mom, in the way that I learned how others' joy could be so much more powerful than my own, and the way that I learned to put aside my own needs when necessary for the needs of someone else, to put someone else first for once. That was a very powerful spiritual practice. And I think it's important to think of motherhood that way as a meaningful practice in our lives. So I'd like to close with a quote from Martin Luther. I bet all of your mom speakers quote Martin Luther, but the father of the Reformation. But he gave a sermon in like 1600-something, and 1538, I think. And he talked about how important the tasks that we do as parents are. And apparently Martin Luther was actually going out and changing diapers because he talks about it. He says those despised and insignificant tasks of the spirit, changing the baby's diapers, cleaning up its sores, washing away its stench, you know, feeding, all those things that just seem really insignificant. He said those are adorned with divine approval as the finest of jewels. All those little things that seem so not important, according to this father of the Reformation, adorned with divine approval as the finest of jewels. So if you take one thing away from what I said today, I hope you take away that your job really matters, all of it. Even the things that don't seem important, those are ways of meeting God. Those are ways of becoming more like Jesus. Those are ways of connecting with God in the daily life of being a mom. And all of that matters. Thank you for letting me speak to you today.
Thank you so much, Julia, for sharing with us about